Welcome back to the third year of the Netflix podcast, Present Company. I'm your host, Krista Smith. This season, we have something really special for you. I'll be exploring a universal human emotion with our guests. Fear, a word that has gathered new meaning for many of us over the past year. Thank you for joining me.
Been through the storm. Been through the hail fall. You still couldn't call my name. There's a world inside your rainbow.
Well, that was the voice of the British singer, songwriter, and producer James Samuel, the mastermind behind the epic Western, The Harder They Fall, who makes his featured debut with this film. And it's an absolute showstopper. I mean, first of all, the cast is off the charts. Idris Elba, Regina King, Delroy Lindo, Jonathan Majors, Zazie Beetz, Lakeith, it's literally a who's who. The music, the costumes, the fight sequences. This movie is going to blow your mind. And I was mesmerized by it. Here is the brilliant James Samuel. James, very nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you, Krista.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about The Harder They Fall. I love this movie. I wrote my college thesis on the Western genre, so you could not have had a more perfect audience than myself to watch this and consume it. And I just love how you've flipped it on its head. So I want to talk to you about why a Western, why the genre, what about it resonated with you so deeply that you wanted to make this film?
Well, you know, growing up in London, they used to always have like the matinees on. They used to have like on TV, they're like 2 p.m. matinee, and they'll show a lot of Westerns. And the UK would always show like old TV serials like Champion the Wonder Horse, High Chaparral, Rawhide, Bonanza. So those would get me addicted from the minute I came out of the womb, because they still show them now. Then I love cinema, right? I love film, but Westerns were always my favorite genre. And then you start watching the Searchers, The Big Country, Johnny Guitar, and then The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and just all of these great Westerns. And then it went to Italy, right? And you had the Sergio Leone and Sergio Corbucci Westerns. And I don't know what was the allure about the Old West for me, but the cowboys and just the imagery, they were just always so cool. So I really just was drawn to that genre of film. And also, I think with Westerns, I could never see the filmmaking behind it. Jim Stewart in Winchester 73, you just accept it as that time and that place. I would never be able to see the filmmaking, no matter how hammy the acting was or how kind of run-of-the-mill or straightforward the story was. Shane was just Shane. He really did exist. Mm-hmm. There was no Michael Landon. Mm-hmm. That's Bonanza. That's real stuff. I think that's what drew me so much to the Westerns. Just the transportation to this real environment, so to speak.
You're listening, like, that is like the classics. Also, I loved watching Big Valley growing up too, with Barbara Stanwyck as the, you know, the female. Yeah. You rarely saw that, but you really saw the female as the kind of power player in these. And also, one thing, you just listed so many great Westerns, lots of great directors and actors, but the one thing that's always missing is Black cowboys in these films. Yeah. Black and brown people. And sometimes even awfully, the Native Americans were even played by Caucasian actors with pancake on. So for you, you've completely turned this on its head, which I love. And in the beginning of the film, and there's no spoilers here, it does say, like, these people existed.
Yeah.
And you completely align with the genre, which I was so into, with all of these kind of iconic images that resonate for us. We remember seeing that, whether it's Clint Eastwood, whether it's Jimmy Stewart, like you mentioned, the cowboy, the lone gunman, the robbery, the trains, all of it is there. But what's different is everybody is Black. And so can you please talk about that and kind of what, aside from loving the genre, what specifically to a Western and amplifying the Black cowboy was important to you?
Well, it was a couple of things. One, as much as I love Westerns, there was always these glaring inconsistencies with them in the portrayal of people of color and the portrayal of women, right? So as soon as we go period, in just the history of Hollywood, as soon as we go period, people of color and women are subservient immediately, right? Women are subservient to men. It's always a weakly written female character who's just helplessly in love. And people of color, if there was a black person in the Western, they'll always give reason for that black person being there. If there was an Asian in the Western, they'll always be wearing blue and doing laundry. If there's a Mexican, they'll show like short guys wearing white and running fast, how they are in The Magnificent Seven, the original. Mm-hmm. Or they'll show like these big, hairy, overweight people, bullets either side of them, which I personally believe that Chewbacca is influenced by those stereotypical portrayals of. I've never ever met a Mexican person that talks like that or looks like that, right? So growing up, I just wanted to see more of myself in those films. So I would just do research and get books. Like, surely there was black people, people of color in the Old West that weren't slaves. I started uncovering all of these rich characters with these rich histories that I was never taught about. I know all the words to Doris Day's Calamity Jane. They got those fancy clothes, pretty ladies with the big chateaus, private lawns, public parks, for the sake of civic virtues, they've got fountains there that squirt you. I just got back from the Windy City. Windy City is mighty pretty, but they ain't got what we got. I'm telling you, boy, we got more style in Deadwood City than all of Illinois. Okay. I've seen that movie so many times as a kid that I know all the words to Windy City. All right. But yet I've never learned about Stagecoach Mary. Hmm. I've never learned about Cathay Williams. Learned about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Jesse James and the Coward, Robert Ford. We learned about all of these people. But you never learn about Rufus Buck, Cherokee Bill, Jim Beckwith, Wiley Esco, Bass Reeves, who was the inspiration for the Lone Ranger. So when I started uncovering all of these characters, I was thinking to myself for years, how come I've never seen them on screen? So when I found out about these characters, I was like, let me just pull them all into one story. I made a fictional story and brought all of these real characters into it and assembled them like the Avengers and told the story of The Harder They Fall. So you can watch The Harder They Fall and then go and really learn about Rufus Buck, about Cherokee Bill, about Gertrude Smith and Stagecoach Mary, and just all of these amazing characters, just to kind of like bring balance to the force, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I love the way you kept to the Western tropes. When I watched your film, I accepted it as reality.
Yeah.
I had the same, like what you were talking about watching Shane. Shane was just Shane. So I would say to you, I felt the same way watching this film. I completely accepted it.
Thank you so much.
I have to, at this point, talk about some of the cast in this, because in that they are playing fictionalized versions of real characters in history, right?
Yeah.
And it is a phenomenal cast. I'll just go through a few of the names here. Regina King, Idris Elba, Jonathan Majors, Lakeith Stanfield, Delroy Lindo, who's one of my all-time favorites, and whatnot. But let's talk about Jonathan Majors, because he is your lead cowboy here. He is the, you know, the gunslinger out for revenge, the classic archetype of the cowboy hero villain that we know. And I love that everybody's a little of both, which is so great in a Western. No one's pure good and no one's pure evil.
yeah. Everyone's shysty.
Yeah.
It's just bad and bad.
Yeah. So talk to me about why you thought he was perfect for Nat Love. Like, what was it about him as an actor, and kind of what was it like working with him?
Do you know what was crazy with Jonathan Majors? When I cast him for The Harder They Fall, Last Black Man in San Francisco wasn't released yet, so I hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen White Boy Rick. Nat Love is really, he was a really hard guy to cast, because he holds the whole story together. While all of this stuff is happening, he has to be kind of stoic and straight and hold the whole film together. But Jonathan was given an interview for white boy Rick, he was just given an interview for it. And he answered one question. For the life of me, I cannot remember what question that was, Krista. I went, that's Nat Love. He is Nat Love. I didn't even read him for the role. He didn't audition, considering that he'd never headlined a movie before. I knew in my heart and soul that was Nat Love. And I knew nothing about him physically. It turns out he's actually a real life cowboy. There's no stuntman for Jonathan Majors in that movie. All of those stunts, he's galloping full speed with no hands, shooting on target. That's all him.
Wow.
He's always ridden horses. He's from Texas. So his family, he grew up like a cowboy, but I never knew any of this. We got on the phone and we were speaking about who Nat Love is. And that evening he sent me a poem and it was beautiful. Even this, just my in a monologue, I'm feeling for the character. And I knew it was him. Like, come hell or high water, I was cast in Jonathan Majors, which is why I love Netflix, because I don't know if any other studio would have let me done that with a person with no track record of leading such a big movie. And Netflix gave me literally zero opposition. They just were like, yeah. And then it turns out he had all this other stuff coming out, which is amazing. But it was pure instinct. It was pure instinct why I cast Jonathan Majors. I'm kind of like that with a few of my cast members. But Jonathan was unique in that I hadn't seen anything he was in. I just saw an interview. Mm-hmm. After which I saw a bunch of things he was in. But I'd already cast him by then.
That is a great, I mean, first of all, he's so humble about his writing skills, because I have talked to him before and he's like, oh yeah, I knew how to ride a horse. He's very like casual about it. But I love hearing that. Facts. He was doing those stunts. I love that.
He said to me, Krista, on set, I went, where did you learn to do that? When he, a full tilt gallop, it's in the trailer, a full tilt gallop shooting his enemies on target. I went, where did you learn to do that? And he said the darndest thing. He said, I can't do it. Oh, what? He went, I can't do it. Nat Love can. But I don't know how to ride. I don't know how to do all that stuff. But Nat Love does. It's such a crazy thing that he just trots off to wherever it was he was going. Like him and a horse became super close, right? You'll see Jonathan and the horse talking to each other. They were inseparable. So on set, I'd look to the far distance and I would see Jonathan having a full conversation with the horse. It was just the most fascinating thing. Him and the horse were a unit, because everyone's riding at that point, but mm-hmm. Jonathan and his horse, it was different. Like, he'll trot backwards, come forward, be doing tricks on the horse. You'd think that he you know, birthed the horse, but it was amazing.
I just love it. Well, one of the other things that, like, you know, exactly, like a horse and the tricks and the galloping, you know, these are all things that we kind of associate with Westerns. But what we don't associate with Westerns is this modern energy. And you accomplish that, obviously, with the script and the dialogue that's happening and the conversations. I'm thinking particularly that modern relationship between both Stagecoach Mary and Nat Love, and then with Regina and Idris. Those are kind of modern, you know, elevated conversations. But it's the music. The music just lights this film on fire. Obviously, you're a musician. You come from a wildly talented family. I was looking you up. But for you, the music is everything.
Yeah.
In this movie. So I want to talk to you about, like, how did you integrate that? What was the symphony that was happening in your head while you're directing this film to know where to put what music when? I just want you to talk to a little bit about tying those two things together.
Well, it's really interesting because I composed the score for the movie, right? I wrote and produced the entire soundtrack. So, but for me, Krista, they are exactly the same thing. So when I'm writing, for instance, you know, they sing their battle chant, upon my return, see you change it so, that road was long, far and way too long. They'll run from me as they ran from you. That fear in me is in a distant view. I would be writing that as I'm writing the scripts. As I'm writing the scripts, I'm writing the motifs for all of the characters. And what was important to me is, as you know, we all watched Westerns growing up. I would always categorize the Westerns by the forms of music in them. So I have my acoustic guitar here. So say like the old Westerns, right, will be like, her name was Krista riding up the hill. And that'll be like the Rawhide type Westerns. And as the music changed, so did the aesthetic of the film. So did the actual cinematography, or vice versa. Then we got into the big orchestral Elmer Bernstein type, Magnificent Seven, for instance. Dun, 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 dun. And then it went to Italy. And Ennio Morricone, who was a college friend of Sergio Leone's, he was using the electric guitar, which was still a relatively new instrument then. He'll have like a electric guitar and just voices, not even big orchestra. He would have like ding 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 ding, like what? With they win, with they win. Like with he made a song for a singer called Pete Tevis, Pastures of Plenty. Sergio Leone heard it and went, that's what I want for my movie. But this has vocals on it. The man with the dun, 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 dun. Sergio Leone said, remove the vocals. I want this. And that became the basis of pretty much all those spaghetti Westerns. So for me, with The Harder They Fall, I was always trying to figure out what is the signature of this movie? What is the signature sound of this film? And when I was like 8 years old or something, I always heard Barrington Levy's song, Here I Come, right? It's a dancehall record. Here I come, stilly ali 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 oh, see, here I come, bam, 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 bam. And I'd listen to that song and I would see galloping. Because Barrington Levy's vocal, he has a signature and he goes, it's like a tongue roll. Stilly ali 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 oh, see, here I come. And while he's going, stilly ali ali ali, I always saw galloping behind it. And now I'm a man and I'm making a film. And I figured, hey, let me rebuild that track, contact Barrington Levy, guide vocal it, have him come in and sing it for the score. And then that's what's in the teaser, right? Almost like the driving force of the score is dub, old school reggae dub. Jing, 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 jing. When I landed on that, I knew that I had it. Like, how do you make this Western new? Give us something we've never heard before, as well as something we've never seen before. And it was all of those things I blended together to compose the score of The Harder They Fall. As I'm writing, because music and film are the same thing for me, I'll give each character their own song, which might not make it into the movie, but they'll have their own song, and from that song, I will discover their motif. So Stage Church Mary's song, because we spoke about Stage Church Mary, her song, which is not in the film, but her song is and her story is a song I wrote for her called World Inside Your Rainbow, right? And she's speaking to Nat Love, and it goes, been through the storm, been through the hail fall, still couldn't call my name, there's a world inside your rainbow, and who's right or wrong, yeah, when heaven is so far, sugar, you still couldn't call my name, when my tears falling down like rain. Still couldn't call my name, this world inside your rainbow. For as the world turns around the same, all the tears falling down like rain. You still couldn't call my name, this world inside your rainbow. And then I would build her story out and her relationship with Nat Love out from the basis of that song. And I wrote that song for her like 10 years ago.
James, I was just going to say, listening to that song, I'm like, that's her. Like that, your whole character has that vibe and feel of the tones of that song that I just listened to. It's like I immediately picture her. Just like now, I only think of that opening song as galloping. It's interesting how that, it's like the chicken or the egg, what comes from it. But I can only now think of that song as those horses galloping, and the opening is amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
Thank you.
And so it's a really seamless thing, the story, the script, the songs and characters. And so it just turns into one big opera. They all inform each other. It's kind of like all one stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. the less we have the harder they fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that also Jay-Z is in here as a producer and you collaborated with him. So at what point does he come in with this? Is he saying, great, that's awesome, or no, pull that back? I mean, where are your own guardrails here for yourself? Like, tell me a little bit about that partnership and how you get to that final product.
I've always said good artists create, great artists listen. So the important thing is to not have any guardrails, right, for me, and just close your eyes and absorb the best of everyone, right? And just listen to everyone. And with me and Jay, can we go back years now, right? Over 10 years. The first collaboration we did was actually with a song with Jay Electronica and Charlotte Gainsbourg. Go figure. I called the song Dinner at Tiffany's. Hmm. And then after them, we did like Jay Electronica's album. This is years ago when Jay Electronica first signed to Roc Nation. And then him and I did Gatsby together. We put together all the music for the Great Gatsby movie with Baz Luhrmann. So me and Jay have always had a collaborative relationship. But what people don't know about Jay, obviously we know he's a great businessman and we know he's an amazing artist, but they obviously haven't seen him in the film space. So they wouldn't know how versed he is in film. This man is, there's not an area he's not familiar with. So when I was writing, he would, without giving away spoilers, where I'll be in a debate with someone about what happens in a particular scene. And this would go on time and time again. Like me and James Lasseter, our other producer, we would be talking about, okay, should Nat Love pull his gun straight away or should he hold it and this and that. And Jay would always be the final word on it. Jay would say, look, here's the thing. I've been in that exact scenario, right? And he'll tell me a story about him and a guy called Pint, incidentally, from his area with one particular scene. I was like, oh my God. And he was like, you wouldn't shoot straight away. You want to get to the bottom of it. There's a reason why you don't shoot straight away. Other times you shoot straight away. He'll be speaking about all those things, or Nat Love's relationship with Stagecoach Mary and the nuances in it. Stuff he went through with his wife was public on the Lemonade album and the 4/4. And Jay would like be talking to me and talking through all of those issues and areas in the script to make it more real. Why would Mary, without spoilers, why would Mary be listening to Nat after he supposedly disappeared? And just all of these things. So he was present in every single aspect of me writing the script and making the music. Like a couple of songs we co-wrote together. Like, it's just working with Jay is like breathing. It's like breathing air. You know what I mean? It's like breathing air, pandemic free.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know. And you did this movie in the pandemic, too. I mean, that's just even more remarkable that this was all of this scope and scale that's able to happen in this film, as well as so many great action scenes and whatnot and emotional scenes. It's all done under this giant cloud of COVID.
Madness. We were meant to shoot last March and we got shut down the day before shooting because this new disease called COVID, and then Idris came down with COVID while we were filming. What was amazing about it, Krista, is it's my debut movie. So we shot in the eye of the needle that's in the middle of that COVID tornado. It was madness. However, because I'd never shot a movie before, having to direct standing 6 feet away from people with goggles and a face mask, it was just like okay, these must be the rules of filmmaking then. It's like learning to drive in a Bugatti as opposed to Mini Cooper, right? If you can't drive, you can't drive. So look, I was just like, you give me the parameters and I will shoot it. I'll shoot my movie. Just tell me where I have to stand, what I have to wear, and let me do the rest. Because, you know, I grew up in the hood in the UK, Harrow Road, Kilburn Lane, Mozart Estate. As bad as the pandemic is, growing up in those areas, it was kind of more dangerous. So I was like, okay, I'm prepared for whatever it is. I just have to get this story told. And I had a great time doing it. I always say, like, the film we make is for the public. The making of the movie is for us. So I would be blasting music on set. Every spare moment, I had my sound man, Anthony Ortiz. He built me a huge speaker in my video village, and I'd blast it out to the whole set. So it was like having fancy dress parties in the evening shoot. It's like a club in the Old West, and everyone's on the street waiting for the turnaround, and we're all jamming. So it was amazing. It was a really amazing experience.
Well, you feel that energy. And there's another thing I want to talk to you about, it, which is the palette. The palette is so rich. The reds, there's so many versions of red, you know, and that color wheel. I didn't know there could be so many shades of red. And then obviously in the blanched white and White Town and all of, you know, the colors and all of that. So can you just talk to me about, like, why was playing with that palette so important to the telling of the story?
Well, one, I think the Old West was super colorful because life is colorful, right? So, you know, when you watch a movie in the 70s, based in the 70s, and it's all kind of hazy and desaturated, I'm like, but that couldn't be how the 70s looked. The 70s would look like 2021, color-wise. And I never really get that in films, like, especially Westerns. I don't really get it. But life is super colorful. All the shades of brown, even the shades of white, it's super colorful. I wanted to see that in the movie, and I definitely hadn't seen it in a Western before. So my production designer and my costume designer worked hand in hand to deliver me that look. My production designer is a man called Martin Wist. He did a movie called Cabin in the Woods. Mm. If you remember the production design of that movie, it is insane. From the Evil Dead cabin to the whole sci-fi world underneath. And then he did a film called Bad Times at the El Royale. And I thought that was a production design-wise, really beautiful movie. And then my costume designer, Antoinette Messon, she was my first hire on this movie. So she understood what I was going for from the beginning. So she would show me all the shades of blue and all the shades of green and all shades of brown, and we had to kind of work in tandem with the production designer and myself to kind of get the right balance and just to make things pop on the screen. Because I always say, Krista, I always say, when you put black people in a Western, it's not a Western no more. It's like watching Star Wars for the first time. So we can really toy with it. Also, you know, there were people in the Old West that were really clean. A man that used to run with Wild Bill Hickok, his name was Charlie Utter, right? He's in Deadwood, the TV show. They said Charlie Utter would only wear clothes imported from overseas. And he was obsessed with taking a bath every single day. Basically, this man was a swagged out dude from 2021. But he was in the cowboy days. When we speak about the Old West and, you know, these people that exist in that space of time that weren't slaves, that weren't subservient, if you ask anyone to guess when Wyatt Earp died, right, they'll probably say, I don't know, 17 or 1803. Wyatt Earp died in 1929, right? Gunfighter OK Corral was 1888. The Emancipation Proclamation Act was signed in the 1860s. There was decades of the Old West with people of color being in there and women being non-subservient, so to speak. I think all of these things and all of these realities lend to how far you can really push the genre of the Western. Like, you and I love Westerns, Krista, but they kind of stopped being made. So we never really got to see what more could be done with them. And when they would make a Western, I suppose like Quentin and Django, he was pushing, but there's no cowboys in Django. So for me, it wasn't necessarily a Western in that regard. But then you have, like, if you have from like Open Range, Kevin Costner and Robert Duvall, but it's still very kind of rainy and pulled back.
Yeah. I think the last one real I think of is The Unforgiven, which is Eastwood, but that's like a visit of Eastwood. That's so heavy with other things because he came to be defined by that in a way, like you said, with all the movies that he did and the spaghetti Westerns, so to speak. It is interesting that it didn't really evolve, but if you actually think about the Western, it was so instrumental in building the business of Hollywood and also instrumental in building the vision of what people come to think of what America is, right? The Scopes, the Lones, the Marlboro Man, you know, all of this imagery is so iconic and embedded in our brains about, like, it's synonymous with what people think about in America, at least in that kind of Hollywood way. Certainly it was. I mean, I think obviously things are changing, but it really was.
Yeah. And Eastwood, incidentally, was a guy that he brought in another genre of the Westerns, which I call the acoustic rainy Western. It's kind of rainy. It's kind of a much more grim telling. I'll say he started with High Plains Drifter. And then into Unforgiven, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Because after Unforgiven, then you start getting movies like The Proposition and movies where it's heavy with rain and the score will just be one acoustic guitar. I'm here to kill you, little Bill, for what you did to my friend Ned. And that was like another genre, but it's just really awesome, man, to be able to tell this story. As you said, turn the genre on its head, offer something entirely new, and swag out with the music. In the words of Little Richard, I mean, that's what you want. You want to feel it in your toes. I want to feel it in my toes. I want to watch this movie and like really be nodding to the score. And I also believe, Krista, that we've kind of lost over the past, I suppose, maybe 15 years or so, we've kind of lost the score a little bit. If we go to the 80s and even early 90s, we could sing all the scores. It's few and far between that I come away from a film with a motif of a score, like in the same way.
Well, I just said what comes to mind to me is like Staying Alive. I mean, you know, the Bee Gees and Saturday Night Fever and that whole thing is like so synonymous. I just don't think we do it anymore. And then I think of the Rocky theme or the Rocky movies, but I'm hard pressed to think of, well, I do think of Beverly Hills Cop and that dun, dun, I can't do it.
Axel, what do they call it?
Axel Foley is his own Axel theme Foley. Music. But it is hard. We don't think of that necessarily. And I loved the way Antoine Fuqua did a little bit in the remake of The Magnificent Seven, which my boys loved. I've seen that movie probably 100 times with them because they loved that Denzel version, right? They just really gravitated towards it. But you heard that little like, you know, he did an homage in the beginning. It was just that little...
He kind of changed the motif in the movie, but on the credits,
he played, on the end credits, he played the actual song. If I was him, I would have used that through the whole film.
That's one of the best themes of all time. And so I really wanted to give us songs and score that we can come away with mm-hmm. with The Harder They Fall.
It's great. And you did. And I've seen the film a few times and the music is just like always, I'm like, who's that song? It just feels so good to be sitting in it listening to it.
And we have like great artists on the soundtrack as well.
The whole time I was watching this film, somewhere in the back of my mind, I was thinking about what else have we not seen on film? Erased feels like too strong of a word, but something that hasn't ever been examined in a real honest way.
What's been omitted?
What's been omitted in our culture? Because I think this film is going to have a big impact on that. You know, and I grew up in Colorado, so part of me is in that West and maybe it's in my bones. And obviously there were black cowboys that I knew, like you said, with your lead actor here, Jonathan Majors, grew up, you know, around horses. So is there anything else that you're examining? I mean, I know this movie is about to come out, but is there something else that you're thinking about in your head about examining and pulling back the curtain?
There's something else, all right, Christoph, but I'm not going to speak on it yet. But yeah, there is. I think this. What's great about working or operating now in the field is there's so much more outlets. There's so much more areas where you can show film, such as the streamers, that the studios aren't as fearful to fund stories with people of color and women in them with prominent roles. I think the studios now are a bit more, like, I know Netflix is a bit more, I wouldn't even say risk-taking, because I don't believe it's a risk showing actual human beings in human stories. I think it's more risk when you just omit a whole race of people. But there's so many areas where we've been, I think the word we could say is omitted, right? Which is not necessarily as strong as erased. I would go to erased, but omitted, there's so many areas that I think now is the time we could have these conversations and we can tell these stories. When I announce the next joint that I'm doing, you're going to grin from ear to ear. Like, I like that James guy. He's special.
Good, I can't wait. All right, so my last question is, I'm discussing fear this season with everybody because I feel like no matter how successful or prolific anybody is, we all have our own relationship with fear, right? Whether it propels us to fight through something, whether it stops us from doing something. And as an artist in particular, it can be pervasive at different times. So I want to talk to you a little bit about fear, just like, what is your relationship with it? And I think this is fascinating, getting to know you over the course of this conversation. You had to make your feature film debut in the middle of COVID with a massive cast of giants, okay? You know, we didn't even get into Idris Elba and Regina and all of those and Lakeith and whatnot, but you're dealing with a large cast with lots of stories that are happening simultaneously and characters and all of that. But you persevered through that and the music and everything. So for you, James, what is your relationship with fear right now? How do you feel? How do you break through it? How do you live in it? You know, how do you work with it? Just talk to me.
Okay. It's a really interesting thing, and it's really strange that you asked that question, because I always talk to people about fear. Always fear of rejection, fear of acceptance, fear of failure. And I don't have those things because I grew up in Mozart State with fear. You'd be fearing for your life. In those areas, I don't have them. I think it's perspective. I put things into perspective, and nothing would compare to, in that regard, to what I experienced just growing up, like being around the environment that I was in. Incidentally, though, we do all have fears, right? Like, I'm super scared of spiders, right? Okay, so peep this. I'm scared of the dark. Up to now, I'm scared of the dark, right? The first song I ever wrote for someone was a girl called Emiliana Torini. She's an amazing singer-songwriter from Iceland. She sung Gollum's theme on Lord of the Rings. This lady's amazing. She's Grammy-nominated. Amazing. She asked me to write a song for her. This is probably like 2007 or something. I was a kid, and I wrote her this song called Serenade. And the whole song is about me being afraid of the dark. It's like a folk lullaby. And I'm really afraid of the dark. Like, if I'm sleeping by myself, there's going to be some kind of light coming in. And the song goes, moonlight falling, picturesque in its dance, midnight calling, moonlight shadows start to dance, for the dark finds ways of being engraved in the light, and the heart bears indentations of yesterday's hurting child. The now we will run with smiles, the morrow will heal the night, for morning comes midnight, make fast with the sun. I can hear my name be reborn on the cloud within the sky beneath the dawn. Oh, I serenade the dawn. And it's about me being a child in the dark and not being able to wait for the sun to come out to end. And I still have that fear today. And that fear of the dark is a bizarre thing because I can't even find reason for it. But the fear of the dark is as prominent and as real as someone else's fear of failure, as someone else's fear of rejection. But ultimately, those fears have no weight. An Uber driver asked me, what am I scared of? And I told him, I'm scared of the dark. I mean, I'm not scared of anything to do with other human beings because I grew up in the hood, but I am scared of the dark. He went, why are you scared of the dark? He went, are you a singer, a songwriter? I went, I'm an artist. You know, I write and I make stuff. He went, that is why. Your imagination is active. I went, really? He went, yes. He went, what are you scared of? I was like, I don't know, but I know something else is there in the dark. And he said, well, if something is there in the dark, it should be afraid of you. Because you come in, what music you listen to? I said, I like hip-hop. Exactly. You come in, you play your hip-hop. You play, I mean, you disturb the thing in the dark. Has he ever disturbed you or she? Ever? I went, no. Exactly. So ultimately, these fears, I think they're somehow there to protect us. Fear of failure, like, it has no power. Like, fear of rejection. Invite rejection in and sit down. You know the girl we used to like when we were kids and we were scared to talk to? Okay, but invite rejection in. Sit it down. You'd realize it's just a powerless, invisible force. It's like we give power to all of these things. There's no logic why I should be afraid of the dark. Krista, I am afraid of the dark. If you turn off all the lights now, I'm bouncing. But I have to go to sleep every night. So I have to deal with it. And I deal with it, Krista, every single night.
Like, what do? You have a night lights or you sleep?
15. I've got 15 night lights. I call it the light switch. Click. I'm just sleeping with the light on. When I'm at home, I'm with my wife and my son. So then it's cool. I can like snuggle up in the dark. When I'm by myself, like out here, it's just something I have to embrace, close my eyes, and get through. With regards to fear in other areas, I think we were just thrown through the ringer growing up on Harrow Road. So you can't help but equate those experiences to what you go through as a professional in a field of like film or music, and you realize that they don't necessarily compare. Mm-hmm. When, the next time we meet, I'll tell you a story of this guy, this Debo in the hood character. And I didn't make any trouble on this guy. Next minute, I heard he was looking for me. It was the most terrifying weekend ever. And he was the first person with a gun we knew. He lived his life like the Old West. And hearing this guy was looking for me, he was like the most terrifying. And then there was this club that was on, and I knew he was going to be there. But the night at the club was so amazing, Christoph. If I missed it, I'll never be able to go. So I had to go. I just went. And making that decision to go, I've never been in a scenario where there was another stronger decision with a more dire outcome than going to that place knowing he was gonna be there. And it was all because, I'll tell you the next time we speak, but it was all because I was listening to a Kate Bush CD. Babushka, babushka, babush. Just because I was listening to Kate Bush CD, it turned into like this big thing in the area. Like, the hood is the most craziest, beautifulest
place. Get in trouble. Kate Bush.
What I've appreciated so much in this hour with you is how every bit of you is in this film. The humor, your passion, the music, the violence, little bits of all of you are in this film. And that's a beautiful thing to actually, I feel very privileged that I got to talk to you because now I understand it all so much.
You get it now, right?
I get it now. And we didn't even talk about the humor in the film is just spot on. It's really well handled. handled and well-paced and everything. So, but it has been an absolute pleasure. And I am going to have another conversation with you because I feel like, you know, we should just maybe.
I'd love to do a part two with you.
Yeah.
And also, you, like, I love speaking to people that like just love films.
Yeah.
As well.
That's like, me for sure. And I realized before I let you go, one thing we didn't talk about in terms of music and movies, one of my favorite films is High Noon. I love that movie for a lot of reasons, but one of it is the music. It's like you're immediately transported into that feeling and whatnot.
High Noon is one of the greatest movies ever for me. And what I loved about High Noon is you get the dread of time from the minute the movie starts. It's that dread of time. You know it's going down. That's one of the films where the title tells you it's going down. Like, this is going down. The title won't really tell you nothing in Tombstone.
Yeah, no.
The title won't really tell you nothing in Shane. Unforgiven, it tells you a little bit. Like, okay, something's happening and someone's not going to be forgiven real quick. It doesn't really... High Noon, oh, it's going down.
It's going that's down.
It's going down.
Yeah. That's one of the, it's on the nose. Like, the man who shot Liberty Valance. Who was Liberty Valance? Like, someone's getting shot in this movie. You know what I mean? So, and it's, and what I love is you recognize, like, all of the, like, the things we've spoken about, all of those things are prevalent in The Harder They Fall. The violence, the humor. Because I always say, as crazy as The Hood is, it's super funny. It's literal comedy all day. Like, it's actual comedy. If you and I listened to What Flies on the Wall in any prison in America, you'd hear laughter. We find humor in the most craziest scenarios. And so for me, humor is as important to drama as tears and sadness. Humor is equally important. And I tried to get that across in The Harder They Fall, with one particular character who's just in his, as far as he's concerned, he's in his own movie. He'll be written about 100 years from now, like, as far as he's concerned. And so everything he does is kind of has wit. And those things are really important for me to portray, especially in a Western where you want to show people that, to me, The Harder They Fall is the Western that people would watch that don't like Westerns. Mm-hmm. Oh, but I'm still going to watch that. Idris Elba, Lakeith Stanfield, Regina King, John Familia, I have to watch this. And then you want to bring them into the environment by having things like humor in it and having people you can relate to. Like, that's just one of the, even in the teaser, I'm lightning with the blam blams. Like, you want to hang out with that dude. I want to hang out with that dude. Go hunting. Like, you want to hang out with Jim Beckwith. So humor is a great ingredient of The Harder They Fall for me.
Well, congratulations, James, on your first feature film. And again, thank you so much for making the time to talk with me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Krista. Speak soon.
Thanks so much for joining me. The Harder They Fall is coming to theaters October 22nd and will be streaming on Netflix November 3rd. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you've been listening. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. Join me next time for more meaningful conversations here at Present Company.